My name is Doug Shelley. It is June 22nd, 2011, and I'm here with good friend of the Grant Lupendunce.
Hey, Doug. Happy Wednesday night.
And happy Wednesday night to everybody. So glad that everybody could join us tonight, those who are joining us live and those who are joining us on the archive. Good to have you. Also those on the Inception Radio Network. Tonight we have the Honorable Paul Hellyer joining us, which is exciting for me. I've wanted to have him on the show for a long time, so it's
me as well.
It's an honor.
We're very fortunate to have him with us.
Yeah, it's an honor. So if you have questions, we'll take your calls. Jamie Havokin, of course, screening the calls. The number is 347-945-7799 if you'd like to, or you can ask questions in the chat room. I will be monitoring the Inception Radio Network chat room as well. We'll try to get to your questions. And as I stated, we are honored to have the Honorable Paul Hellyer, former Deputy Prime Minister of Canada and many other positions, joining us tonight. Paul, welcome to the program. Great to have you.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, all the way from Canada and, of course, duh. You know, I don't even know where to begin. I guess I'll begin with... your serious interest in UFOs began just a few years ago, in 2005. Can you tell us how that started? What got you into it?
Well, there's actually a young fellow in Ottawa, Ontario, which is the capital of our country, and he started sending me stuff on the subject, and I was too busy to read it.
I
told him, I was honest with him, I told him I didn't have time to read it, but he was very patient with me, and this went on for about probably 2 or 3 years, from maybe 2003 to 2005, something like that. And he sent me a book called The Day After Roswell by Colonel Corso. And when that came, I said, oh, that looks like an interesting book. I'll have to read it sometime my summer holiday. That's about the only time I get to read. So I put it away, and in the summer of 2005, I thought it would be, summer of 2004, I thought it would be a good book to read, but I couldn't find it. And in the summer of 2005, I was looking for another book, couldn't find it, and I found Roswell. So I said, well, I'll take that with me. In the meantime, I had watched the ABC show, the two-hour special, at the request of this Pierre Junot, my friend in Ottawa. And you know, I said to myself, look, there are a lot of policemen and pilots, commercial pilots and ex-Air Force people talking about this subject on that show, and they're not liars. You know, they're not going to be making up all this stuff. And so that sort of conditioned me for what I was about to read. I started to read the Corso book, and I got about a third of the way through it, and I said, is there any possibility this could be fiction? Actually, I read very little fiction because I just don't have time. I have so much else I have to read. And the year before, I had read The Life of Pi. I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's a fascinating book, and you don't know, or at least ordinary people like me don't know, until you get almost to the end of the book, whether it's fact or fiction. So I said, could it be that? And then I said, no, because I recognize too many of the places and too many of the U.S. generals that I knew of by name to say this is all made up. This sounded real to me. And as I went on, I had a nephew at our little lodge where I am at the moment, and he came over and asked me what I was reading, and I told him, and he said, well, I'm a skeptic. So it's a free country, you can be a skeptic if you want to. So he went home, and in the meantime, I finished the book, and I was absolutely convinced. But he went home and phoned me about 2 days later and said, I talked to the general, and he says every word is true and more. And I said, well, that's interesting. He said, well, where can I get a copy of the book? And I told him. So in the meantime, I had been invited to speak in Toronto. And I had no intention of accepting the invitation, none whatsoever. To make matters worse, I was getting married in a week. My late wife had died the previous year after 59 years together.
Sorry.
And this lady that I married was someone I had known for 35 years, and her late husband was my best friend, and we had done all sorts of things as couples, so we decided to get married.
Good for you.
Anyway, after reading the book, I said, there are issues here. You know, what is going on? And are the United States Air Force still treating these aliens as enemies? And are they, what kind of mischief are they up to? And besides, why don't the American people know? They have a right to know. They've been paying for a lot of this stuff.
Preach it, brother.
And under your Constitution, the members of Congress are supposed to vote on projects that they know about and take responsibility for. And here they've been putting up a lot of money, knowingly or unknowingly in some cases, for projects that they were not aware of, except maybe in the vaguest of terms. So I said, there's some big issues here, and I'm going to have to go public. So then after my nephew phoned, I decided before I would go public, I would get in touch with the general, because I had met him a couple of years earlier at an air show. And so I was given his number, and he was given a heads up that I was going to call. And when I did, he started right out with the same words, every word is true and more.
Huh.
And with that confirmation, I decided that I would, after getting the consent of my wife and telling her it was a one-off thing and sort of we'd never hear of it again, I decided that I would go public in September of 2005 and talk about it and talk about some of the issues that I felt were really important, particularly to the United States, but also to the world, because this is a
mm-hmm.
a big issue that transcends any national boundaries.
It's, yes.
The boundaries are you know, immense. The whole galaxy, in a sense, is involved. So that's what got me involved. And then, of course, after I went public, well, then the information started pouring in from all over the world. People sent me copies of papers. Some of it was just junk, but a lot of it was good stuff. Some of it was previously classified at very high levels and all that sort of thing. And I was briefed by some of the best-known people in the business. And so I figure if I was sort of in kindergarten in 2005 on the subject, that maybe I'm grade 5 or 6 now, something like that.
So that's how you got started. Now, this conference that you spoke at, that wasn't the MUFON, the first one, or was
it? No, it was Exopolitics Canada.
Oh, that's right, Exopolitics.
Victor Vigiani and Mike Bird were the sponsors of the concert and of the convention or convocation or whatever it was. And they deserve a lot of credit because they went out on the limb, and I don't think they broke even, but they felt it was so important that they wanted to get it out in the public. And they, of course, were delighted that I spoke out because
I'll
it sort of was a landmark. I have the dubious distinction now of being the first person of cabinet rank in the G8 group of countries to
mm-hmm.
have said unequivocally that UFOs are as real as the airplanes flying over your head.
Well, that very, very courageous move. No question about it. Is the Canadian government as involved as the American government is in this whole thing, or is it something that the American government has tried to dominate and exclude other world governments from participating in or being a?
I think the latter is true to a very large extent. Whether there has been some cooperation with. Well, there has been some exchange of information, undoubtedly, certainly with the UK, and whether there's been any with the Russian government or not, I don't know. But I don't think the Canadian government was really in the loop after the very early stages, going way back to, 1950 era.
Which is, to me, absolutely incredible, since you're the neighbor we rely on to work in collaboration with to protect our northernmost borders of a hemisphere from any kind of attack. That's absolutely unbelievable to think that that the Canadians would not have been advised of that.
Yeah, but they haven't just kept it a secret from us. They kept it as a secret from most of the American people too.
Yeah.
When I went public in 2005, I said there should be both a national debate in the United States and a worldwide debate. But how can you debate a subject that doesn't exist?
Right.
You know, in the mind's eye of certain press members and this sort of thing. That's just science fiction.
Well, the media has been in collaboration with whoever it is that, you know, they've made it so that nobody will cover it. Nobody will really cover it, you know. It may be covered at a very local level. I'm sure the same thing is true of Canada, where it's covered on a very local level, but then it never gets national media attention or the attention that it truly deserves.
That's true. I think it is beginning to change a little bit. Very slowly in the last few months, but still they've got a long way to go before they treat it as a serious subject.
Well, the thing that gets me is the fact that here we have vehicles that can penetrate our airspace with impunity and have done so for well over 40 years. And what I find fascinating is, what are they so reluctant to tell us about? I guess it boils down to either they don't either know themselves and are unsure of what's going on or are not party to the information, or the other runs true and we've made a bargain with the devil here.
Well, that is possible, but that's just one more reason for disclosure. We really have to know what's been going on because General Twining designated the visitors from other planets as enemy alien, and right from the beginning, every time they came in our airspace, we tried to shoot them down.
Mm-hmm.
And the question arises in my mind, are we still trying to do that? And if they were largely friendly, as most observers believe, why would you shoot at friends? And where is it likely to get you in the end? And, you know, to what extent have we made a priority of trying to deal with them militarily? And how much money has been spent on it, and was it the best use of the money when the world's, you know, suffering in so many ways?
Wow. Or
not ways that the money could have been better spent, both in the United States and in other areas of the world, to build a just society instead of
absolutely.
The sort of mess that we've got now.
Wow, well spoken, well stated.
Yes, and, you know, it's time for us to put down, you know, tribal mentalities and look at each other as you know, we're all brothers here. We're all related, and it's time to really, you know, unite and you know, do what we need to do. I mean,
well, we have to, because look at the situation today. The most important subject in the world today is global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw an article, I don't know if it was in the New York Times or in the Toronto Globe Mail a couple of weeks ago, saying that world temperature's gone up 1 degree due to man-made. If it goes one more, the polar ice cap will melt, and sea levels will go up 20 feet. Well, sea levels go up 20 feet. Just think what will happen to hundreds of thousands, probably millions, tens of millions of people all the world, over the
mm-hmm.
world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. over Florida.
Coastal areas and mm-hmm. Pacific Islands and Bangladesh and everywhere.
Well, I think the Maldives threatened too right now. Are there certain parts of the Maldives where they're going to be completely underwater if this continues at this rate?
Well, a large portion of the, you know, build-up areas of the world will be the coastal cities.
Yeah.
And we've got to do something about it, and it's going to be very expensive, and one has to wonder why we haven't paid more attention to doing something about it and doing something about it very soon. And that's where the connection comes in with the ET technology, because I learned way back that at least a decade ago, it was claimed that the United States, in cooperation with the visitors from other planets, had developed some exotic forms of energy that would allow us to do the changeover from fossil fuels to exotic energy, to clean energy, within the 10-year deadline that I think that we actually have. But nothing is being done about it, and you've got a small cabal that's really running the world, and they've managed to keep that technology under wraps until they can cash in the trillions of dollars worth of oil assets that they've got. So this is not a good state of the world that we've got, and it's not going to change unless literally hundreds of thousands of people in the United States and Canada and elsewhere band together and say, look, it's time you came clean, told us what's going on, and it's time you started changing your priorities and tried to save the world for future generations instead of blowing it on wars and so on that aren't going to get you anywhere.
Well, we're certainly not demonstrating to our interstellar neighbors any worthiness to join that community the way that we're going. I mean, we got to be some really backwater, warring, you know, small culture that the only possibility I can see them being interested in us would be either to exploit our natural resources or for pure curiosity, or that we're possibly a threat. Because otherwise, what value? How could they possibly even relate to us?
I think they find us pretty primitive. And I think that they find that our spiritual and moral standards are pretty low.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that that is too encouraging. And I really think that they were available, as one of them told Philip Corso at Drek, to help you if you want us to.
Uh-huh.
And the question is whether we want them to or not. Certainly they're advanced in agriculture and medicine and many areas. So if that is true, why aren't we cooperating with them to see that if we could build a better world where it would be more fun for them to visit or whatever?
What do you think the answer to that question is, you having been, you know, so high in government?
Well, I think the problem is that with governments, and this is certainly true of yours, is that they're really not in control.
Mm.
But you have what I call in my book the light at the end of the tunnel, a survival plan for the human species. I call them the cabal. But they're really the richest, most powerful people in the world who are basically amoral and who don't really care about anybody else. All they care about is making money and having power. And they're the same people, they are the people who are running the international financial system, which is nothing but a total fraud. And it's been going on that way for a couple of centuries, and nobody is doing anything about it. In the United States, for example, 99 years ago, the Congress passed a bill that handed over the sovereign right of the United States to create its own money to a group of private bankers.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Reserve System.
Uh-huh.
That was the biggest swindle in the history of the world, probably.
Yep.
And it's still going on, 99 years, and Congress hasn't reversed it. They were told right away that the great mistake had been made, but nothing was done about it. And it still hasn't been done, and there's just no reason for this massive unemployment, both in the United States and around the world. There's no reason for people to be starving or not have enough clothes or a roof over their heads. It is just a combination of too much self-centeredness and a monetary system which makes basically slaves of us all for the benefit of a very, very small handful of exceedingly rich people who don't care about us or about the future of the world, either one.
Sounds positively positively medieval. So that we haven't advanced any more than we're part of the fiefdom, you know, or where there's serfs. And if that's truly the case, it's a pretty dismal picture. Because
it's interesting. After on one of the books I wrote, quoted somebody who said that after the Civil War, slavery had been abolished in the South, but it had moved to Wall Street. And that it would be just as bad or worse, and it would affect everybody, which is exactly what it's doing today all over the world. And we don't have to have these things that are going on in Greece and Ireland and Spain,
mm-hmm.
and all of these places where the IMF comes in and puts up a little, not money, but credit for these people to pay the bankers the interest on their bonds, and then to tell them how to run their countries and have to cut back on services and lay off people and all this kind of thing. This is, as you said, medieval.
Yeah.
It is primitive in the extreme, and we're putting up with it.
And that's the really surprising part, because people really are not making an effort to do anything about it. You know, I mean, if once you grasp the big picture, I mean, it can be really depressing, because we don't have a lot of control over those folks. I mean, I think it's really interesting that when they just want on a whim want to raise the profit margins, all of a sudden gasoline goes up. And, you know, for a while here in the United States, it was almost $4 a gallon, which in the rest of the world, they probably were laughing at us because they're paying way more for it.
Sure.
But you know what? It almost as if it conditioned us so that when they dropped it back down to $3.50, so it won't be so painful the next time when we go to $4 a gallon.
When it goes to $4.50 the next time.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, and then they almost like pull back because they do feel a ripple from the public, the anger and everything else, but the public doesn't follow through on it. And it's really unfortunate, and it's a sad state of affairs that this small group of people, and I'm inclined to agree with this 100%, have so much control.
Yeah, it's a very small, probably 100 families or less, and they really run the world. A few of us have put up a website that I would recommend to your listeners. It's called www.victoryfortheworld.net. That's www.victoryfortheworld.net. And if anybody doesn't believe what I'm saying about the monetary system, and thinks I'm exaggerating, like go there and do a couple of things. Get a look. That's one of the one or more of the books that are shown there. One of them, written by a lady by the name of Ellen Brown in California, called Web of Debt. If you bought that book and read the first 100 pages about how the banking system has evolved, you'd want to throw up. It is just so, you know, so maddening, really, that this is allowed to happen. And I made a speech to the 21st International UFO Congress in Scottsdale, Arizona, in February, called Global Fraud, Global Hope. And I would really recommend it to your listeners, and you can download it from that website. And it's sort of a précis of the things that are wrong in the world and what we have to do about them. And then the other thing that's on the website are action plans, one for Canada, one for the U.S., and one for the world. And you can go to the action plan and see what it recommends. And if you like any of the things it recommends, join the club and do something about it, because time is running out. And I don't know if you have noted the increase in floods and storms the last year or two all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've had storms up here like we've never had before. And then you see them in Pakistan, and you see them in China, and you see them in the United States, and you see them in Europe. You see them all over, and you say, what's going on? Well, something's going on. And we've got to take more cognizance of what it is and do something about it, because if we don't, our grandchildren are going to have not the kind of life we've had. It's going to be much worse for them than it has been for us. And
no, I think it's going to be much different for them than it was for us. We live in a time of affluence. I'm 61 years old. I live in a time of affluence and plenty compared to my grandparents who lived through the Depression. So I'm grateful for what I have, but I'm not so sure I'm ever going to have but what we had again for a long time. And it's you know, I think my children and my grandchildren are probably going to have, that's something that they're going to have to deal with as well.
I'm a child of the Depression, and it's the raw poverty that I saw then that got me into politics in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I went to university and asked my economics professors if recessions and depressions were essential, and they couldn't give me a straight answer.
Check, check. Mm-hmm. All right, can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. That's why we. That's why nobody's responding to anything I'm saying. For some reason, my mic goofed on me. Okay. What we have to do now is we have to get this back on the topic of UFOs and and this family. And the question that I have, Paul, that you'd mentioned about these families that are controlling the world, is, are you saying that these families don't want the UFO knowledge out, or are they aware of it?
Some of them are aware of it, I think.
Okay, so is this something on their agenda? Are they actively managing this type of information or not?
I think they have some members in the MJ-12 now, and they're part of the cabal, and they're keeping wraps on the whole subject, and that's the way they like it.
Okay, so. All right, so let's get one of the questions I've had is, in your position as Deputy Prime Minister and all the other positions you've held in government, did any of the UFO stuff come by your desk? I mean, were you aware of anything going on in that manner?
The only thing I was aware of, when I was Minister of National Defense, and I got sightings reports. And they were very similar to sightings reports in other parts of the world. About 80% of them were attributed to natural phenomena. The other 20% were just unexplained.
And so
that's about as far into it as I got, even as Minister of National Defense.
Did Canada?
Sadly, I was too busy at the time. I unified the Army, Navy, and Air Force and put them all in one single Canadian Armed Force.
Yeah.
Which was kind of a war of its own.
Well, I can imagine. That must have been quite a challenge.
That's an understatement if you ever made one.
Yeah.
So I was too busy to be worried about UFOs. I didn't even know the questions that I wanted to ask. If, you know, it's not like now where I would have a lot of questions to ask. But at the time, I just knew what came across my desk, and as I said, it was something I looked at, and then on to the next thing.
But would it be safe to assume, Paul, that information, those black ops and all that black information is so compartmentalized that even in the Canadian government system that some of that must be going on and you would have never had any access to that despite your position?
No. Absolutely not. There were some things that were shared, you know, new developments where when you build a stealth bomber, for example, and it was going to fly up our west coast, then the information had to be shared so that we would know what it was when we picked it up on radar.
Uh-huh.
But this was very small stuff.
Uh-huh.
And the big stuff is very closely held, and it's so closely held in your country, too. I'm sure you've heard of Edgar Mitchell's shot with the head of Naval Intelligence?
No, I haven't.
He asked him about what was going on and if he was in the loop, and the Chief of Naval Intelligence was outraged to find that he was not. So he went storming into somebody and said he wanted to know what was going on and was just told politely, sir, you do not have a need to know.
Right. I think Barry Goldwater ran into the same problem, too, as well.
He did, yes.
And he was basically told, it's none of your business, Senator, yeah, and just back off. And then Bill Richardson, I think the governor of New Mexico, also tried to get some additional information. But, you know, when you look at it, what's really remarkable, Doug and Paul, is the fact that a lot of the information that to me really substantiates the whole case for UFOs came out of the Freedom of Information Act documentation that we got. There's numerous reports in there.
Sure.
Numerous reports that go back to the 1940s that verify a lot of the things that Colonel Corso said in his book, which I also read and thought was a really interesting book. I liked in the book about how they farmed out the technology. And years later, Paul, I read an article in Smithsonian Magazine where somebody said, well, you know, given that technology, if our scientists were trying to, reverse engineer it in 1947, it would take them about 50 years to get it down right. And so it always made me kind of wonder that, you know, a lot of these things with the, you know, like the night vision and the new computer circuitries and integrated circuits and those sort of things, you know, if that's where they originated at.
Well, some of them did, I have no doubt. Fiber optics and things like that. But this is the small stuff.
What's the big stuff?
Yeah. And they've been working on the big stuff, including propulsion systems and replicating the ships for 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to assume that if some of the best minds, when by that I mean the people with the most scientific background and understanding, have been working on these subjects for 60 years, that they've accomplished a heck of a lot. And I think they have. If they told us everything they knew today, it would be, you know, science fiction plus, I think.
So you adhere to what Colonel Corso said about bases on the moon and that we've been capable of, not necessarily, I don't think it was interstellar travel, but interplanetary travel for quite some time?
There are people who allege that. I don't know it, so I can't confirm it.
Yeah.
But there are people who allege it, and I've seen and read statements by people who were involved who have claimed that that is true. But I have to draw a line between speculation, what I believe, based on, you know, the evidence I've seen and the people I've talked to, and what I could stand up in front of a parliamentary or congressional committee and say that I knew it to be true, because this is just speculation as far as I'm concerned, although I think my personal conclusion is that so much has been accomplished that it would just boggle our minds if we knew about it.
All right, let's get to some questions. Does Canada have any kind of a group that investigates UFOs, much like the U.S. used to have Blue Book and currently has who knows what?
I think the answer is yes, although, again, I can't prove it. I've seen things that would lead me to believe that there is a special section in the National Research Council that gets reports and where they're filed away in a secret cabinet, and nobody can see them except the people who are in the loop and are cleared for it.
And that wouldn't have fallen under your oversight as defense minister?
Well, if it did, I didn't know about it.
Huh.
I think this came later, after I was Minister of Defense. Those were the early days, and things were a little more open then. You were getting more information in your national newspapers then than you are now by far.
Okay, so to reiterate, your belief in extraterrestrials being here is based on what you read in Corso's book, but also the verification you had from the general, or can you just reiterate why you believe that they're here?
Well, the sources are numerous, as you know. There's a tremendous amount of literature, and the one thing the general told me was that there had been face-to-face contact between the United States and visitors from other planets. And he didn't say maybe, so just it was point blank. And I have friends in the business. Paula Harris is one of my friends, for example, and she's put me in touch with a couple of cases recently. The one, the crash in 1945 in New Mexico. And I talked to one of the boys who actually saw he was a boy at the time, but one of the men who was actually there and saw it and went and was inside I think he or his buddy, one of them, went inside the machine and were there when the Army captain came to ask permission to bring in the trucks to take it away and called it weather balloon, which is the same thing that they called the one at Roswell, or one of the ones at Roswell. And so I have talked to him personally at length and convinced myself that he was telling the truth.
Okay.
And then Charles Hall. I talked to Charles Hall too, the colonel from the Bentwaters case, at great length, and interviewed him personally, and know that he was telling the truth. And then I talked to Charles Hall, who worked for the United States Air Force at the gunnery range and I guess it's Nevada, and was working with what he called the tall whites, a species that I had never heard of at the time I wrote my book. And he got to have a good relationship with them, and he was cleared to wander around the range anytime without supervision, and it was simply because he had learned to understand and work with this species, and he told me that they had been working with the United States Air Force for years, and that they had scout ships come in there, and it was a hangar for a mothership that came into the side of the mountain, came in the nights of the full moon, and he said that the tall whites had been exchanging technological information with the United States Air Force for some period of time, and this was in the 1960s when he was working there. So in the speech that I made in Nevada, in Arizona this year, I referred to that case and said, if the United States was that far advanced in the exchange of technology in the 1960s, where are they today?
Right. Okay, here's another question. You had made the statement that the U.S. military is preparing weapons that could be used against aliens. Could you elaborate on that, perhaps getting us into an intergalactic war?
Well, they've been working on the technology that they got from the aliens. And not only that, but the particle guns based on the work of Tesla and others. And this, I am told, again, I can't vouch for it, but I've been told that that's what Star Wars was all about, and that is the primary purpose of the anti-ballistic missile shield, that the weapons are ones that can be aimed in either direction, up or down, and can be used to help control the situation on Earth, but equally, if not more important, to shoot down incoming UFOs. And so and I don't know exactly where they're working on them. It was indicated to me that maybe that was one of the things they were doing in Area 29. And
Area 51 or a different one?
Well, Area 29 is south of the...
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay.
And I do believe that they have not one, but maybe two or three kinds of weapons now that are capable of disabling and bringing down UFOs.
Okay. Does Canada have any kind of a department? This is a question from the Inception Radio Network chat. Any kind of a department that reverse engineers crafts? Have they ever gotten any crafts?
I don't think they have done any reverse engineering at all that I know of. There was a crash that landed in the north of Manitoba, one of our western provinces, many years ago. And by the time our Department of Transport people got there to investigate the accident, it was already surrounded by U.S. Army guards. And so somebody checked with Ottawa as to what they should do, and they finally got the word back to let the Americans have it. So like with other parts of the world, sovereignty was not taken into account. They just grabbed the thing and took it, and wherever they take the craft and added it to their inventory for examination.
Might makes right, huh?
Yeah.
Here's another question. In your position, were you ever in contact with NORAD? Do you believe that they monitor UFO traffic?
Well, was I in contact with them? Of course, I was. We were members of NORAD, so
of course.
I had the position of appointing the deputy head of NORAD, and he, I think, would have been in the loop, as it were. I think he would have to be pretty well, but there was a limit to how much he would say to me. I know from another case where he told the Prime Minister something, and then the prime minister said to him, "Have you told your minister?" And he said, "No." And he said, "Well, you better go and tell him." So this is the way the system works. That the I don't know if you're familiar with the proposition put forward by Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine.
No.
Who says there are two governments, and the provisional and the permanent. The permanent government consists of the Fortune 500 and the top lawyers in Washington who do their legal work, and the top PR people that do their public relations, or one might be cynical and call it propaganda. And then the top civil servants, both military and civil, and that they really run the show. And they have a lot of information that they think that they're the custodians of, and they act as if they run the country or the world, as the case may be, and only give the information to whomsoever they please. And that is the situation, I think, in your country.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when you have information denied to the President of the United States on the basis of no need to know, that raises some very serious questions about democracy.
Amen.
I sometimes wonder why we can go to war to try and promote democracy in other countries when we haven't got it in our own.
Well, one of the key issues here, at least in Florida, is, some of our more conservative politicians are tearing down the educational institutions. So, you know, if you dumb down the population and they don't really understand what their rights are, you know, no big deal, you know. And, I mean, it's reminiscent of Fahrenheit 491 or whatever it was by 451 by Ray Bradbury, you know, where people just stayed in their houses and believed everything that they saw on the screens, completely conditioned and happy, you know, placating.
Tremendous propaganda machine worldwide that's been promoting globalization and promoting the permanence of the financial system and promoting the idea that maybe global warming isn't as serious as we think it is. And all of these things designed to serve the purposes of this small group of people and the ones who benefit from it at the expense of all of the rest of the people in the world.
Well, you know, the thing that's also kind of alarming about that, that's equally alarming, is you would think if there were some benevolent aliens out there who had mankind's best interests at heart, what would be to prevent them from plopping down and sharing, you know, one of their paradox engines with us, you know?
Well,
and then the whole cabal would come apart.
The answer that I've received from several contactees and others is that they have a treaty which prevented them from doing that.
Uh-huh.
And they could only intervene if they were invited to intervene.
Uh-huh.
By the government.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate, but the government is not the people.
Well, but you know, by the same token, I wouldn't think that they might be entirely blameless either. Let's assume, first of all, we have difficulty fathoming our neighbor's mind, let alone an alien's mind. But you know what? How do we know that that's, you know, that they don't care if they give us technology? What are they getting in the trade-off? Are they allowed to abduct our people? Are they allowed to do other things, carry on experiments? You know, what's the trade-off in that devil's bargain?
Well, you've raised a very good question, and I think that the answer to it is something that we will only know with totally full disclosure, and if, in fact, there was a treaty between the United States and one or more of the species, and if so, what it said. We won't know until we see that.
Do you think that's coming? Do you think full disclosure is coming?
Not right away, no. I think the system is so ingrained that the people who have the knowledge will not give it up unless it is pried out of them.
And why do you think they're holding on to it? What's your assessment?
Well, I think they like power, and I think they don't like to share it, and there may be some advantages to them that they think they, you know, that they can use in some way that maybe actually it could be diabolical in its intent.
Well, they know best for us. They know what's best for their underlings.
Well, that's what the whole cabal is about, because David Rockefeller said that it was when he was talking about the advantages of a world government, that it would be better to have an elite group, including bankers, run the world than the old system of individual countries. And so this is the mentality of the people who have been moving us in the direction of a single world government that would not be elected, that would not be democratic, and that would be, in fact, autocratic and running by the...
Well, that would certainly work well for the corporations. There's not a question about it. But, you know, to get back to a point where we talked about entering that devil's bargain, that's part of some of the mythology that goes on. I mean, Eisenhower, I read reports, or alleged reports, back in the 50s, where Eisenhower, supposedly this was his famous, went to the dentist, and he disappeared out of Palm Lake, Palm Springs he was staying. And supposedly he was, according to the UFO folklore, he met with aliens at the time. They wanted us to sign an agreement with them, one of the groups. And one of the groups, the agreement was supposed to be that in return for exchange of technology, we would lay down our nuclear weapons. And, of course, they said, the powers that be for us supposedly said, no, that's not going to happen. Another group came by and said, well, listen, man, we'll give you the technology, but we want to abduct some of your people, and we'll let you keep records. And, of course, supposedly that all went by the wayside. But whatever happened...
Well, we don't know whether it did or didn't.
Yeah, right.
That's our problem.
Yes.
And you won't know until there is full disclosure, and as I'm afraid we're going to be a lot older than we are, and some of us still won't be around when...
I don't think we're ever going to know. You know, I always think, Paul, of a little snippet from a TV program where it showed people at a convention in the 1950s, and one of the guys stands up and he goes, any minute now, within the next year or two, they're going to announce full disclosure on this. They can't keep it, you know, secret anymore. And that was like 1950. So, I mean, we're still hearing that. We're still hearing that. It's going to any minute now, or I've got the keys, and they're not going to disclose it to us.
Yeah.
Because it means such an incredible shift in social and cultural and industrial paradigm that it's going to change the world forever. And I think with these people, with greed in mind, they don't want that to happen for a long, long time.
Yeah. I'm not in the business of selling books, but my latest book, Light at the End of the Tunnel, The Survival Plan for the Human Species, has a long chapter in it about the extraterrestrial presence and technology, which is good for primer. For anyone who is a skeptic, you can recommend it to your friends and they can start out with that and then go from there. But what it does, the book puts together the things that have gone wrong in the world and who is responsible, who's pulling the strings, and then what we have to do about it, the priorities that we have to change and the policies that we have to change. And it's all tied together. It's just like the cosmos. The cosmos is a unity. It's not a bunch of just individual planets flying around. It's all tied together in some mysterious way that we're just learning more about all the time. And that's what the ideas that I'm trying to get out in the book is that we've got to take accept the new reality, the wider, broader reality, and then to start changing the way we live and changing the way we look at other people and really, well, trying to build the kind of world that we all dream about and talk about.
Give your website, too, where they can get your book.
Yeah, you can get the book from Amazon or from Barnes & Nobles or from Author House of U.S., or you can get it from my website, which I don't usually give out, but it's where is it here? Paul Hellyer Web. So Paul, HELLYER Web, all one word, .com. You can get it there, but I would like people listening to go to victoryfortheworld.net and get engaged. Because it's okay for us to chat and say this is what has to be done and things are not going well and they're not going to improve in the immediate future. But somebody's got to do something if those things are going to change. And so I would recommend the victoryfortheworld.net. People go in there, look at the action plans, and if they decide that they want to help save the world, save the country, to do something, and enough people do, but something maybe will actually happen someday.
Well, you know, you had mentioned one of the things that I had read, that you had spoken out against Stephen Hawking's proclamation that about extraterrestrials. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's just that he was hypothesizing about them in a way which I felt was really very unfair, because actually he should really know what's going on to a greater extent than he does. And he was portraying them in a way which I thought was unfair, because anybody who has had contact with them knows that they're far more advanced, and that they are real, and that they're here, and that it's not just that they would come and treat us like earthworms if they were to finally show up someday. And I just felt that he was a little bit out of line, even though he's a great scientist.
Interesting. So here's a question from the Inception Radio Network chat. Is it possible that the ETs communicated this to the cabal, that disclosure would result in dire reprisals, and this is why the cabal fails to disclose? If so, wouldn't the cabal's cover-up be a wonderfully moral act?
I think the opposite is true. I think the agreement was involved disclosure, and that, like a lot of other treaties, that we have broken the treaty and not lived up to the disclosure. And I think they're quite upset about it, and they're passing the word through a lot of people around the world that they are upset, and that we should get the word out that we should change our ways and be more open.
Do you think that you kind of indicated this earlier in the interview, but the technology that aliens have, if they're offering it, you think we should accept that?
Well, you already have.
Okay. For the good of humanity, have we accepted that technology?
Yeah, a little bit for the good of humanity, but mostly for the good of the military-industrial complex, as General Eisenhower called it.
Wouldn't the aliens have a moral issue? Wouldn't you think they might with that?
Pardon?
Wouldn't the aliens have a moral issue with only dealing with these governments, what they could obviously see or not acting in the best interest of the people always? Or
it's difficult. You know, if you want to accomplish something in the world and only governments can do it for you, I guess it's a moral issue, but where else do you turn? You turn to your government for help, and they don't give you any. They may not give you any satisfaction. They may be the wrong place to turn. In many cases, they are.
Well, I'd like to see the aliens making themselves verifiably known to the people. It's the people of this planet who make decisions for the people of this planet. Unfortunately, we do have the governments set up that are supposed to represent us, but when that's obvious that they're not, you know, and I know the whole prime directive thing, and it's kind of a delicate issue, and I'll grant you that. It's just that, you know, there's a lot of us, including you, including me, and Grant, all of us, there's a lot of people who want exactly what you're talking about, a better world, you know, the governments to act in the best interest. We want peace. We want to stop with this primitive tribal warfare baloney. We want to evolve. There's a ton of people who want this, and yet, you know, we're still trying to come together. You know, and the internet's been a big help, but we're still trying to come together.
Maybe we need an American spring.
An American, I'm sorry?
Amen to that.
An American what?
An American spring, like the Arab springs.
Mm.
People, exactly, is what we need. But I don't think the American people
are
ever going
to
do that.
I'm talking about with weapons, because I'm...
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Yeah, you're not advocating that. You're advocating
people banding together and saying, look, we want
yes.
change, and we want it. And we want it now. And if enough people really got through to their elected leaders that they had to change or they were going to be toast in the next election, something would happen. But they would have to be credible.
Yeah, rather than people having massive voting drives, you know, and getting people informed and doing it at a grassroots level, it's all done through the media. And the media has served their masters well.
It's been the social media that have been responsible for these changes that have taken place in other parts
true.
Of the world.
Yes, true.
And I would think that probably that's about the only recourse we're going to have here.
Mm-hmm. I think you may be right.
Well, some interesting things. Let me ask you this. Have you ever had a UFO sighting yourself?
I have, yes. Last October for the first time. Actually, the place where I'm looking out at the lake now, just the dock is down about 200 yards from where I'm sitting, and someone photographed one from there. I guess it was 3 years ago. I have a picture of it in my book, A Light at the End of the Tunnel. And my wife and I were here last October for our Thanksgiving, which is earlier than yours, and she decided to go out in the patio and look up the stars, and first all she could see was trees, so she went out the other way in the driveway, and I followed her out, put on my hat and followed her out, and she said, there's a star in the east, and I looked up and there was, and then I turned the other way and I said, hey, there's a brighter one in the west. And pretty soon we were both engrossed and we almost broke our necks looking at this thing for 20 minutes as it sort of dipped and dived around. And we eliminated one thing after another. We eliminated being a star or a planet or a space station or a satellite. It just it didn't fit any of the molds. And I double-checked on the space station when I got back down to Toronto. And actually, I saw it a couple of nights later doing the same kind of things. It would change position in the sky by 2 or 3 degrees in as many seconds.
Wow.
And this, of course, is something that only UFOs with their tremendous acceleration and deceleration can accomplish.
Well, that sounds fascinating. We are running out of time. The hour's gone fast. Paul, will you please mention your book again and where it can be obtained?
Yeah, it's Light at the End of the Tunnel, A Survival Plan for the Human Species. It can be obtained from Author House of USA, from Amazon, or from Barnes & Noble, or from my website, which is paulhellierwebb.com.
Well, we really appreciate you taking your time out this evening to join us. It's been nice, long coming.
It's been a real pleasure, Paul, and thank you for your courageous move and leading the charge. I totally support your efforts, and I'm going to visit the website and see what I can do to help out. So thank you so very much.
That would be great if you pass the word around, and if enough of us get together, a miracle can happen.
Yep, and there is no boundaries between us. That's what we all know. We're all part of this one gigantic and beautiful tapestry. So.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. We maybe have you on again. We wish you very well.
Good to
all
be with
the best.
You.
And we thank everybody for listening tonight. Thank those in the Inception Radio Network chat room as well as our own. Thank those who are listening to the archive. Please join us next week for another episode of Paranexus Universe, another interesting one. Thanks, Jamie Havikun, also for being executive producer and doing his work behind the scenes.
Amen to that.
Everyone have a great week. We're out of time. Take care.
Bye-bye, everybody.